Good afternoon. My name is Latasha, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the NGS MEC Open Meeting conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during that time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Anyone who speaks must disclose any conflict of interest on today's call. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Ms. Carolyn Cunningham. You may begin the conference.
Thank you, Leticia. Can everyone hear? Okay, can you hear us on the phone?
I can hear.
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, welcome, everyone. Thanks for your patience while we were getting set up. We're happy you're here, and we'll proceed on with the meeting. We have four policies that we're going to discuss today. Two of them have presentations connected with them, and otherwise the other two do not. So I think we'll get started with our first policy. Craig?
Thanks, Dr. Cunningham. As you mentioned, there are four. We'll take them one by one. The first one is the percutaneous vertebral augmentation for osteoporotic vertebral compression fracture, then the biomarker testing prior to initial biopsy for prostate cancer.
Hold on, Craig, hold on. They're having problems hearing in the room, so we need to figure out.
Okay.
Latasha?
This is Latasha.
Hi, this is Lakita. I just received a note from, I guess, someone on the other lines that they are not able to hear anything on the phones. Not now, but when we were speaking, I guess.
All participants are in a listen-only mode, and it is complete silent now.
Okay, I'll verify if they mean now. Thank
okay.
you.
Lakita, this is Virginia. I just sent a chat note to say that I couldn't hear anything because there is no sound at the moment, but I don't know if that's what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yes. It's completely silent.
You know,
now.
I guess they have us on mute at the moment.
Yeah, that's because no one's talking right now.
Yeah, it's
right.
Muted.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, do we have everybody?
I'm still here.
Good.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Craig. How about the people who called in? Can you hear? You're not set up to speak.
They'll tell the operator.
Okay.
The operator
can
okay.
you guys hear, Doctor?
Okay. Can y'all hear through the microphone?
Yes.
Kind of, sort of, maybe.
Okay.
Okay. We'll start over.
Okay.
But Craig, I think that the issue wants you to take a different path as far as the order of presentation.
Who does?
Speak then, Dr. Hogg, and then.
Let's go ahead with the order that they are on the slides.
Okay. And can everybody hear me now so that problem is resolved?
Yes.
Is that a yes?
Yeah, everything's yes.
Okay. All right. So I was just, I think this the slide currently up on the WebEx is the four policies that are up for comment today. The vertebroplasty policy, the biomarker testing for prostate cancer diagnosis, the microinvasive glaucoma surgery, aka MIGS, and water vapor thermal therapy for LUTS BPH. You can go to the next slide. So the first policy up for a comment is percutaneous vertebral augmentation for osteoporotic vertebral compression fracture, EL33569. This is a collaborative LCD among the MACs that resulted from a national CAC held on March 20th this year, which was instigated by a recent spate of negative publications. This slide includes the draft LCD's positive coverage criteria, encompassing fracture acuity, severity of symptoms, length of non-surgical management, and the need for multidisciplinary team consensus. Next slide. Okay, this slide just lists the contraindications to coverage, so the flip side, basically, of the other slide. Next slide. In summary, we decided that the preponderance of evidence favors consideration of early vertebroplasty in select patients. I don't think we received any requests to present on this topic. Anyone in the room or on the call want to make a comment?
Yes,
we have one comment, Craig.
Okay.
One person at this point.
We're getting the person the mic, so.
Thank you very much. This is Dr. Shukumar Bhuvanendran from the Illinois Society of Anesthesiologists and pain physician. I have no conflict of interest with any of the companies that make this or device for vertebroplasty. I just wanted to make a comment.
I'm having a hard time hearing it. I don't know about anybody else.
Maybe put the mic like this.
Can you hear no better, Craig?
Yes, just on the comment on the inclusion criteria.
Yes, yes, I can hear better.
Excellent.
Okay, thank you. Under points.
Do we have a disclosure? Can the speaker give us any, announce any conflict of interest he has?
Yeah. So let me repeat that again. My name is Bhuvanendran, Bhuvanendran, and I'm from the Illinois Society of Anesthesiologists, and I have no conflict of interest in this procedure. So specifically talking about inclusion criteria, point C, where it says, let me read that to you, and then I'll tell you my comment, the multidisciplinary team consensus, and in brackets it says referring physician, and comma, it says treating physician, and then there's no brackets. The question is it just the referring physician and the person performing the procedure, or does it have to be a radiologist as well in this multidisciplinary team? And the way it is written is not very clear. I would propose that is the referring physician and the person performing the procedure is sufficient for this multidisciplinary team. Thank you.
Dr. Cunningham, can you summarize it for me? I'm not sure. I couldn't hear it quite clear enough to totally get it.
He's concerned about the item C, I think, in the indications.
Right. Yeah, I got that much.
And he was
not clear.
He's concerned about the clarity of it. Who is going to be required?
Okay. So it says, was there a question about the referring physician?
The question about, Craig, is where the brackets were more grammatical. Is a radiologist mandated? He is supporting that it just be the referring physician and the person performing the procedure be the only required personnel on the to define the disciplinary team.
And Lakita, Alicia, could you go back to the slides before the one we have up, please? That's the one that has indications on it.
So the intent is that it requires a referring physician, and it gives
Lisa,
It gives two examples of that. Examples: rheumatologist and endocrinologist, treating physician, in other words, performing the procedure itself, and then two more team. Potential team members would be radiologist and neurologist. So, and that was, you know, that came from each of those has a citation, so it's linked to some guidelines or something like that, and that was linked to the CIRSE guidelines. So, if the speaker could submit his comment in writing. You know, we'll take a look at it and we'll respond to it.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, just as a comment, as I said, this is again Dr. Bowen is speaking, about 10% of these procedures are done by pain physicians across the country from data examination. So there's no performance by that category of physician group in this category C. And so therefore, I totally agree with the referring physician and the person performing it, but having a third physician group examine this patient again would prevent treatment for this acute condition and you're trying to treat these patients with a surgical procedure. So I would encourage two groups, the referring physician and the person performing the procedure, and including the term anesthesiologist, comma, pain physician, be included in this category of physicians. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any other comment in the room, or
do we have any on the line?
Your first question comes from Douglas Bill.
Yes, I have a comment. Just something to point out. First, these changes to the inclusion exclusion criteria, they're logical. They're beneficial for the patients, I think, and reflect the current literature. So well done. The only difficulty, and I will submit these in writing, is that because these are included changes on top of an old LCD, there are things that don't make sense. For example, previous versions allowed treatment of more than three vertebral compression fractures for people that have multiple myeloma or steroid-induced osteoporosis with subsequent fracture. And this includes criteria that are the RAND UCLA methodology criteria that were only for osteoporotic vertebral compression fractures. That's an example. The other example is one of the inclusion criteria includes the timeline of less than 6 weeks provided it meets certain criteria, and that's reflective of current practice and current literature. That's good, but it doesn't mean that the previous criteria fractures greater than 6 weeks should be eliminated. It's just additive to that, and that should be clarified. Example of the exclusion criteria that need to be modified that just don't read as intended is it says can have none of the following other causes of back pain. Well, everybody that has a vertebral compression fracture that's osteoporotic will have some other cause of degenerative disc disease or facet arthropathy. So that needs to be clarified a little bit. Another example of that is greater than three fractures. Another example is allergy to cement. You can have other fill materials. So what I would include on ask on the exclusion criteria is that the same criteria that were included on the inclusion criteria just be included on the exclusion criteria to bring that up to date. And that's using the same literature as was used for the inclusion criteria. I have all of these comments in writing and will submit those.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Beal, thank you for your comment and support for the policy in general. This is replacing the old policy, so I'm not sure if there was confusion about that, but the old policy will be retired once this becomes effective. This policy does not address anything but osteoporotic compression fracture, so there would be no expectation that the other indications, cancer, et cetera, that they, the expectation is that they would be covered. This policy and its restrictions only apply to osteoporotic compression fracture, but we'll take a look at your other recommendations and respond.
Will there be another policy that involves neoplastic fractures?
I don't think so. I think that the feeling was that the most of the controversy and certainly most of the activity is in the area of osteoporotic fracture. That's certainly what most of the experimental data addresses, so that's what we focused on.
No, that's very true. The neoplastic fractures represent a very significant category in a very significant and debilitated patient population. So if this is the case, I would think that needs to be discussed, because that wasn't brought up at all in our preliminary call earlier. And I know a certain portion of people, I'm speaking for the Society of Interventional Radiology, there's a whole subspecialty that does interventional oncologic work, that, and this is a substantial portion of that.
Yeah, again, there's a lot in Medicare that isn't addressed by policy, most, in fact. We try to focus on those things that we feel need a policy or need some type of restricted coverage. If you feel like that there needs to be careful coverage or more restricted coverage similar to this that should apply to the cancer patients, we'd be happy to look at that.
For now, I'll submit my comments on this and make a couple of editorial comments regarding the previous policy and the relationship to incorporating the new changes in the new policy. I think that's just the mechanics of facilitating that incorporation will be the main thing.
Thank you. Any other comments in the room or online?
Your next question.
Go ahead, operator.
Your next question comes from David Schultz.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that the less than 6 weeks of duration of, after the fracture was identified, that seems quite short. I mean, we often wait 8 to 12 weeks before we might consider vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty.
Well, I think most of the literature looks at, or at least attempts to look at, acute fractures as defined by time, which is less than 6 weeks. So we're trying to stick to what the data shows. I know that there's some future. I think Vertos 5 is going to address more chronic fractures, but most of the literature address acute, and in fact, some people are focusing on hyperacute, less than 3 weeks.
Okay.
Thank you. Operator, any other questions?
You have a follow-up question from Douglas Bill.
Just a comment. The VAPOR trial done by Bill Clark focused on fractures less than 6 weeks, and there's another randomized control, and that was a placebo-controlled randomized control trial. Another randomized control trial by Yang also focused on this patient population, so there's quite a bit of recent evidence on the less than 6 weeks to be treated patient population, as Dr. Halb just stated.
Thank you.
There are no further questions at this time.
Any other questions in the room?
No more questions here.
Okay. So hearing nothing, no more further questions, we'll consider comments on this draft LCD closed. Thanks, everyone, for the comments. The next, if we could go to slide 8. Yeah, so I guess you're already there. We're going to cover the next three policies, which are revisions to those policies. The official comments are limited to only the specific changes noted. Next slide. This policy, biomarker testing prior to initial biopsy for prostate cancer diagnosis, DL37733, the change here was addition of coverage of the EPI test, comparable to several other tests that were previously covered, and this addition was made on the basis of recently published literature, and they're listed down there, those two. The first is a revision to the NCC Prostate Cancer Early Detection Guidelines, and also a second validation study. The reference is listed there. I'm only aware of one registered presenter on this topic, Mr. McLean, a representative of the test manufacturer. Mr. McLean, if you're there, please proceed. And also, if we could get okay, you already put his presentation up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. Next slide. Our test is Exosome Prostate IntelliScore. This is a test that is run by Exosome Diagnostics, a wholly owned subsidiary of Biotechnique Corporation. And we're speaking in support of the proposed changes. This test is used in a population of men who have a gray zone PSA result where it's indeterminate as to whether you should proceed with prostate biopsy. The clinical reality is 80% of these biopsies prove to be unnecessary because the disease is benign or a low-grade prostate cancer that does not benefit from treatment. We've created a novel test in the space, urine-based, looking at RNA from the patient and calculating a risk score for high grade or the prostate cancer that needs to be treated. And it addresses our test, the clinical concerns that have been raised by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force about unnecessary biopsy and the over-treatment of low-grade prostate cancer. This is the most extensively validated test in the space, and Dr. Haug cited the recent publication in European Urology and the inclusion in NCCN guidelines as of January of this year. And I'm speaking today to support finalizing these changes to the local coverage determination to include EPI. Next slide, please. The EPI test is a urine-based test. It's very simple for the sample to be collected. Again, it looks at RNA markers of high-grade prostate cancer. It evaluates the levels of those markers using qPCR, and then an algorithm looking at those levels of expression create a very simple risk score. Unlike the other tests that are on the market, this test is standalone. It does not include any standard of care risk factors already being considered by the urologist in determining that risk score. So it is completely independent. It adds new value to the assessment of the patient and the need for biopsy. So physicians utilize this single risk score along with the standard of care factors that they already consider to work with the patient to determine whether it's necessary to proceed with biopsy. Adding this test to that discussion can help avoid up to 50% of unnecessary prostate biopsies. The next slide, please. EPI is the most clinically validated test in the space. It's supported by 14 peer-reviewed publications and presentations. The clinical studies supporting this number more than 5,000 patients across 11 different patient populations in the United States. One study that we've done, it provides level 1 clinical evidence. Our two validation studies provide level 2A clinical evidence, meeting the standards for evidence here. The validation studies are published in leading journals in the urology space, and we are publishing data from a large 1,000-patient utility trial that is showing the actual value of the test in practice. That will be published this year. That study shows not only did we avoid 30% of unnecessary biopsies, urologist compliance with the EPI result is 93%, and when the EPI test is available, that population where it's available versus a population where it isn't, the test also helped out of 500 patients identifying 30 more men with high-grade prostate cancer. So the clinical benefit of the test is significant. Next slide, please. At the beginning of 2019, EPI was added to the NCCN guidelines for early detection of prostate cancer. It is put into the guidelines at the same level as the other tests that had been under this coverage determination. As a further brief update, since submitting these slides, I just want to inform you that the EPI test has been cleared by New York State Department of Health. The lab and the test are now certified. That has significant implications because New York State Department of Health is a designated reviewer for FDA, so it's substantiating that we've met FDA evidence standards. Also, we were just informed a week ago that we have been given designation by FDA that this is a breakthrough. What that means is FDA has assessed that our technology platform, looking at exosomes, is a breakthrough technology, that there are no FDA-cleared or approved tests that meet this clinical need, that EPI is going to have a significant benefit for clinicians and patients, and that EPI is approval by FDA will be in the best interest of the U.S. population. Thank you. Next slide, please. So in conclusion, we strongly support these proposed changes to the LCD to include coverage for EPI consistent with the other biomarker tests, and we recommend that NGS should finalize DL37733 as proposed. Thank you very much for the time today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McLean, for the presentation and support of the draft. One question I had for you, you mentioned level one study. Is that the one with Tutrone as the PI? And if so, that's not published yet, is it?
That's correct, Dr. Haug. It's a level one study. There were 1,000 patients who were being biopsied. We collected a sample and ran an EPI test for all 1,000. As part of the study, these patients were blinded and randomized. An EPI test result went back to the same urologist for 500 of the patients. It wasn't available for the other 500. So with the same urologist at the same centers, we were able to observe how they made the biopsy decision with and without the EPI report. That is in draft now. The one-year follow-up period has been completed. We're drafting that publication. It will be submitted over the summer and will be published this year.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is that that was one of the reasons we have somewhat constrained coverage of all these tests, is that there were no level one, there was no level one data, and I just wanted to make sure that that as of now at least included the EPI test, that as of now there is no level one data that's been published. So please, please get that information to me when it is published.
We absolutely will. Thank you very much.
Anyone in the room or on the call want to make any additional comments?
I don't see anyone in the room, Craig. How about
operator?
There are no questions via the phone line.
Okay. All right. Then we'll consider comments on this draft LCD closed.
And, Craig, you're talking about closed in the meeting today, but not during the comment period.
Right. Closed the meeting today.
Yeah.
Yes, so let's go on to the next, I think, slide 10 in the original slide deck on NIGS. No, that's the Dr. Katz's presentation. If we go back to the
NGS
Dr. slide deck.
Craig, I think Dr. Katz is ready to present.
Yeah, but she wants to go back.
Well, okay, let me just...
You need to. Will I? Sorry.
I just want to introduce the. Topic here. So the next policy under consideration is microinvasive glaucoma surgery, MIGS, DL37244. There were two changes to this policy. The first one, a new device called iStent Inject. Coverage for this device was added, identical to the original iStent device. Based on pivotal study data, the Samuelson reference down below in the slide. And also we deleted coverage for CyPass, which was another completely different device because of the FDA recall due to safety concerns last September. Two people are registered to speak on the topic of iStent Inject. The first is Dr. Katz, who's the Chief Medical Officer for Glaukos and also a professor of ophthalmology at Thomas Jefferson University. Okay, we can switch to his presentation. Dr. Katz, please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Appreciate the opportunity of speaking to you today about iStent Inject, which is used for the treatment of glaucoma.
Craig, can you hear him well enough?
I can. I can hear him fine.
Okay, great.
Great. Thank you. My financial disclosure, as you heard, is I am the Chief Medical Officer for Glaukos, the maker of the iStent. Glaucoma, as some of you may not know, is a disease of the eye where the pressure is too high and leads to damage of the optic nerve and blindness if left untreated. Currently, there are two ways to treat glaucoma by lowering intraocular pressure. That's either to help the fluid exit the eye or decreasing the fluid production inside the eye. Next slide, please. Glaucoma is a very common disease, unfortunately. It's the second leading cause of blindness in the world, the number one cause of irreversible blindness, which could be prevented by lowering intraocular pressure, the only treatment we have currently for this disease. The worldwide prevalence of glaucoma is estimated to be approaching 80 million by the year 2020. Unfortunately, 6 million of those patients are expected to be blind bilaterally because of inadequate treatment or access to treatment. Since glaucoma prevalence goes up with age and our population's aging in the United States, there's going to be a definite increase in prevalence of the disease within our country. And unfortunately, many of the patients remain undiagnosed. Up to 75% remain undiagnosed in our country. Next slide, please. We'll hear a little bit later, but the treatment for glaucoma can be very challenging, especially early in the course of the disease, where many of the patients remain asymptomatic initially, and the treatment with medication can be fraught with a lot of problems with compliance with chronic therapy on a daily basis. Next slide, please. This slide is just showing the kind of the current treatment paradigm that we have for the treatment of glaucoma, starting early in the course of disease with medical therapy, drop therapy on the eye, laser treatment as well in the office, leading typically in the past towards incisional surgeries like trabeculectomy and tube shunts, which are high-risk procedures that we resort to when there are no other effective therapies for the disease, and the alternative would be blindness if left untreated. All of these, again, I must emphasize, are to lower intraocular pressure, the only treatment for glaucoma. Next slide. The eye stent was a bypass device to help fluid flow out of the eye and thereby lower intraocular pressure. The original eye stent was approved by the FDA in 2012 with the CPT code 0191T. And you can see this is an L-shaped stent device. It's about 1 millimeter long. More recently, the next generation of iStent inject was approved by the FDA in 2018. And these two stents work in the same fashion as the original iStent in terms of improving outflow of fluid outside of the eye, with CPT code also 0191T initially used, but we're asking that 0376T also be used for this device. Next slide, please. This slide summarizes many multi-center trials, longitudinal studies funded by the National Institute of Health, all with the common theme of lowering intraocular pressure and making a difference in the outcome of the disease. In other words, lowering intraocular pressure definitely stopped the progression towards loss of vision and blindness if pressure was lowered effectively. This translated into 1 millimeter reduction equaling a 10% reduction in the rate of progression of the disease within a year. Next slide, please. I'm going to review some of the evidence specific to the use of the eye stent and how it works in lowering intraocular pressure. Next slide. There have been perfusion studies done on cultured human anterior segment samples as well as whole eye perfusion models. And in essence, what this shows is that the placement of a single eye stent does improve flow of fluid out of the eye, which should lower intraocular pressure. But if you place it an additional stent, it improves the outflow that much more and lowers the intraocular pressure yet further in these kind of experimental lab studies. Next slide. This is actually a human trial, so this is now in the operating room, and I'm just going to highlight for you two different patients here in this picture. The first two rows are a one patient, patient A, and the second row, patient B, showing that when you inject a dye looking at flow before an ice stent is placed, you can see a certain flow pattern that once you place a stent, which is the second row, there's a marked enhancement of flow in two regions. So the placement of two stents improves flow of fluid out of the eye in two regions that really are enhanced tremendously by the placement of two stents in two different locations. Next slide. This is now looking at the clinical setting of how it actually does lower intraocular pressure. And this meta-analysis really combines data from 28 different studies, almost 2,000 patients' eyes were looked at, the analysis here. And there are two things I want to point out. Number one is that the intraocular pressure reduction looking at one, two, or three stents, there is an incremental benefit in lowering intraocular pressure. The lower the pressure, obviously, the better for our patients and increasing the safety of preserving their vision. And going for one to three stents, there's an incremental improvement in lowering intraocular pressure. Also, on the other graph here, I want to point out that there's an additional benefit of reducing the need for glaucoma medications. Again, the compliance issues, the side effects of medications, we're always trying to keep the medication use down to minimum. And you're much more likely to get down to a lower medication schedule with multiple stent use. Next slide. As far as the duration of effect of multiple stents, this one study site showed that yes, you could lower intraocular pressure going out to 5 years effectively and also reduce the amount of medication needed at 5 years of follow-up using two stents for the reduction of intraocular pressure. Next slide. This last slide summarizes a little bit of what we're trying to point out today with the use of multiple stents and the benefit of multiple stents in glaucoma surgery. I was involved in this trial as one of the investigators, and this was looking at the use of iStent 1, 2, or 3 for the reduction of intraocular pressure. Now, in the United States, the iStent is approved for use in conjunction with cataract surgery. So cataract surgery is done and a stent is placed. In this study, there is no cataract surgery, and we're not suggesting to have a new indication here, but the reason for this study being done is to show the pure effect of an eye stent as opposed to combining with cataract surgery, because cataract surgery does also lower intraocular pressure to a modest degree that can be transient. So this is looking at eye stent alone, no cataract surgery, one, two, or three, and this shows is that there's a definite reduction of pressure with one stent, but it's certainly better with two or three stents. There's a further reduction of pressure going from 30% to 37% and 43% comparing one, two, and three. And if you look at the target pressure, we have target levels of pressure we try to attain with surgery for glaucoma. And if you have a target level, let's say 15 in the eye, the ability to reach that target with multiple stents is 85 to 90%. With a single stent, we can only approach that target with about 65% of the time. If you look at the survival curve of the ability to keep patients off medication, multiple stents are much more likely to keep people off glaucoma medication and reach the target level of intraocular pressure. The last comment I'll have for you is that when you look at these results and the multiple surgeons involved, including myself, this was the first time we had an opportunity to do the surgery. So this was before it was released in the United States. This was in an experimental closed system here that we were involved with. And the results after this study, meaning after the learning curve, are certainly, in my experience, even better than what I'm showing here. But nevertheless, the theme here is that multiple stents are more effective than a single stent in lowering intraocular pressure and keeping patients off of glaucoma medication. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Katz. Yeah, I had a couple questions for Dr. Katz, especially since he's the chief medical officer at Glaukos. Do you or the company advocate a selective approach to implanting one or both iStent inject stents?
I think at this point it's at the discretion of the surgeon on a case-by-case basis. There are certainly some patients that one stent may suffice, but in the majority of patients, I think two stents are often desirable, but that's really at the discretion of the surgeon at the present time.
Okay, because the device is the two-stent system, and that's what was FDA approved, and that's what we're covering. So to my knowledge, they really haven't done a study where they've just done one of the iStent inject stents, which was different than the original iStent. iStent stents, too many stents. So my point is that what we're covering is the two-stent system. We don't know what the results would be just using one of the two.
Well, I think, as I pointed out, I think in this last trial that there's clearly, when you're talking about multiple stents, there's an incremental benefit which is supported by basic science research as well. And this is reflected in clinical practice also. We certainly have had experience with a single stent in the past, and now we're having experience with two stents as well. But there hasn't been a direct comparative study, as you mentioned, in that sense. We do have
right.
The
original. My point is that we don't know what the iStent inject stent by itself, one just by itself, would do. The pivotal study and pretty much all the studies I've seen have involved putting in both of the iStent inject stents. That's what was FDA approved. That's the device defined by the FDA that was approved. And that's what we're covering. We're not covering just one of the two.
Right. Again, the experience has been, and it's identical in terms of mode of action to the original iStent that had pivotal studies published. And then we have now the iStent inject, which are two stents, as you mentioned. But I think the evidence suggests that multiple stenting does have a different outcome than single stenting. There are studies looking at, for example, two versus three stents as well, combined with cataract surgery, where there seems to be a benefit to three versus two stents, and that is in the literature as well. So we do have some information with multiple stents being more effective in lowering intraocular pressure than a single stent.
Right. But you don't have data of what one iStent inject stent does.
No, but again, I don't want to be repetitive, but I apologize, but I think that the original iStent really accomplishes the same purpose and is identical in mechanism of action to the
It's
two-stent.
A different design, though. It's a different design.
Well, the design is only different in the sense of one is mushroom-shaped and one is L-shaped, but really they're going through the same pathway, and the pathway enhancement is the same between the two. There's no difference really there in terms of mechanism.
I guess my point is that we're covering the two-stent system, not one stent of the two-stent system. So we'll probably make that clearer in the final policy. Hopefully you can communicate that to your users. The other question I had, you're still on that slide. The last slide that you talked about, comparing the 1, 2, and 3, that
yep.
you were, I think, first author on, it's really hard to find any, either on the slide or the paper, that denotes whether any of this is statistically significant. Am I missing something, or, why wasn't there much mention of statistical significance in this paper?
Yeah, I apologize. There are p-values for this, and when you're comparing, for example, the ability to control intraocular pressure with two or three versus a single stent, it is statistically significant. And I've left off also the need for medication use. The need for medication use is dramatically different between one stent versus multiple stents, in that in the one stent group, 18 ended up needing medication to control pressure, whereas only three or four cases in the multiple stents required medication and follow-up. So those were statistically significant differences.
But again, if they're not mentioned in the paper itself, right, these statistical significances?
In the most recent paper it is, so I think we can kind of look that up for you.
Okay, the 2018 paper, I did not find any. There was one mention of a non-statistical difference in visual acuity, but otherwise, if you do a find on the word significant or statistical, nothing really comes up. But you can, yeah, if I'm wrong on that, please send me a paper and we can, and I can be corrected.
We'll check but, that. Thank you for bringing that out, though.
Okay. Appreciate it. Thank you, Dr. Katz. We have a second speaker on the topic, Dr. Chacku, who's director of the glaucoma service at Loyola University. Dr. Chacku, please proceed. Dr. Chacku, are you on?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. So I'm Anakshi Chacku. I'm the director of the glaucoma service at Loyola University Medical Center. And I have the opportunity to speak today, so thank you for including me today. So Dr. Katz just actually talked about what we're talking about here today as far as glaucoma treatment and care. Glaucoma is a very challenging disease actually to treat coming from a glaucoma specialist. Patients with glaucoma don't know that they have the disease unless they're detected clinically by an exam, and it's very difficult to discover that you have glaucoma until you have actual an examination by an ophthalmologist or optometrist, someone who can identify this disease in most patients. When patients actually notice vision changes from glaucoma or actually have peripheral visual field loss, they're really advanced, they're very advanced in their stage of the disease, and it's really, really more critical in getting their pressures down. Mainstay of treatment here. So it's really important to identify these patients. Many patients go undetected, as Dr. Katz said, and treatment challenges really occur because of this. The standard treatment for glaucoma, glaucoma treatment is usually medication, laser, as well as surgical options. Medication does offer a unique set of challenges, as Dr. Katz actually touched upon. Patients do not want to take glaucoma medications every day. It's very difficult. Adherence issues are very high in your glaucoma patient population. Patients that take glaucoma medications can tell you that this is not an easy drop to take. It really irritates the eye quite a bit. Ocular surface issues really occur in many of these patients. Many of these drops are made with preservatives as well, and so this really becomes an intolerance issue for many medications that are available on the market for these patients. There's also a cost issue here that comes into play, and many patients can't afford all the treatment that they need. And many medications, patients may start on one medication initially, but often need two, three, four medications as time goes on. And as you can imagine how difficult it is to really take many medications every day like this, it can be very difficult for patients in controlling their disease. That's why we need to look at other options. Laser is an option as well. However, this is limited in its duration. And surgical options have always been reserved more for invasive procedures until now. Next slide. So this is where mixed or micro-invasive glaucoma surgery really comes into play here. This is a very safe procedure. As Dr. Katz mentioned, the indication here is actually to be done in conjunction with cataract surgery. We actually do the actual procedure of iStent inject through the same incision as the cataract procedure, so it doesn't offer any additional incisions to the patient. And it's very safe, very minimally traumatic. So this is a really great option for patients. We can intervene early in the disease process, mild to moderate disease, as opposed to advanced, which we would usually reserve for the more invasive procedures. And patients really tolerate the procedure quite well. Glaucoma is a disease of the aging population. We have many patients that are getting older over time. Many of them cannot sit for a long procedure, and offering them a quicker procedure that can be done in conjunction with cataract surgery really is a benefit here. Next slide. So this is a little bit about the preoperative planning that we as surgeons think about when we see patients in the clinic. I'm actually also the glaucoma service director, as I mentioned. I teach our residents this procedure as well. And it's really important to kind of talk about what was involved in surgical planning when we discuss these options with patients as well. So we see a patient in the clinic, they have cataract and glaucoma. We identify the severity of the disease, look at the number of medications they're on. We look to see if they're an easy patient to examine, if we can actually do this stenting procedure here. We actually do goniopsy, which we actually look at the angle or the drain of the eye, and that's where we kind of deal with the inflow-outflow pathway that Dr. Katz had mentioned earlier. And we want to make sure the view is good in order to do this procedure. So these are really things that we think about when we're doing this. This is really a higher level processing, and that's why so much training is really involved in learning these surgical procedures. Next slide. So when I teach my residents, you know, the really important thing is to make sure that they practice, practice, practice. This involves dry lab practice, wet lab practice, just kind of giving you an idea of what's involved from the surgeon's standpoint and learning a new procedure like this. Practicing in the OR, really enhancing our muscle memory. Next slide. So when we do these procedures in the operating room in conjunction with cataract surgery, we do them under the microscope. We actually have to place a special lens on the cornea, the top part of the eye. The front part of the eye, the anterior chamber, must be maintained, and it's actually very, very sensitive to pressure. So when you place this procedure, you actually place this lens with one hand on the surface of the eye. You maintain very little pressure, but you have to maintain enough contact to get a clear view to the drain of the eye in order to implant the stent. The other hand actually is used then to go through the incision with the injector and implant both stents. Next slide. This is the old design that we had discussed earlier. Next slide. And this is the new design for the iStent inject. So this is what the view looks like when we're doing the procedure. As you can see, there's a kind of a trocar that's kind of coming out there. That actually has two stents actually placed on it. What you do is you go ahead and approach the trabecular meshwork. You go ahead and implant one stent. And then you actually have to shift to a different location with your hand and implant the second stent. Now that may seem not challenging at all, but it's actually technically very difficult. This whole time you are maintaining the view with your other hand, making sure you're not placing any pressure. You have to move your other hand to another space in the canal, go ahead and implant the stent. The patient may move at this time. There's always some blood reflex with the first stent that could also inhibit your view. And the space maintaining the anterior chamber during this time also is technically more challenging. So implanting two stents actually is a more technically difficult procedure than implanting one, and I just wanted to make sure that we understood this. Next slide. So let's look at some of the studies that have been out there. Dr. Katz reviewed some of the randomized controlled studies. There's also been ex vivo studies, but there's been some real-world data that's been out there. So this is a three-year study that showed continuous reduction in IOP and medication use with iStent inject with cataract surgery. This was a prospective single surgeon study, 81 eyes. If you can look here, the mean IOP in these patients or intraocular pressure was 22.6. This was a 37% reduction at 3 years, down to 14.3 of mean IOP. As a glaucoma specialist, I can tell you this is a very important thing. We do look at basically measuring the intraocular pressure and looking at the reduction, and that's how we treat our patients. Every single patient with glaucoma, we look for a decrease in intraocular pressure. The also important factor that really is to note here is that the mean number of glaucoma medications that were seen preoperatively in this patient group was 2.5 medications. At 3 years, 0.8 medications were found to be used by the patient population at 3 years, so a 68% reduction. I can't stress enough how much this really means to glaucoma patients. This is not only a numbers thing, but this is also a quality of life issue for our patients, and it's really important to stress this point. Next slide. This is another retrospective study that was actually done in Australia. This is a five-surgeon study group here that looked at their patient population for 1 year retrospectively doing cataract surgery with iStent inject. If you look at the mean IOP, it was around 18, and it dropped significantly by 23% to 14 at 12 months. The mean number of medications here preoperatively were 1.7, and postoperatively was 0.5, so 72% reduction. If you actually look at the patients who are medication-free, preoperatively only 18%, but postoperatively, this was statistically significant, 76%. Again, stressing the importance of reducing medication burden on our patients. Next slide. And the last study we're going to discuss here is a retrospective study results that favored iStent inject over iStent in terms of IOP reducing potential. So, you know, the whole thought process as we discussed here is basically looking at outflow. We are targeting collector channels with every stent. More stents we place, the more collector channels we can target, and then the theory is to decrease intraocular pressure. And you can actually see that that was shown here in this study. If you look at iStent inject, the mean IOP definitely reduced compared to the iStent, actually more so, and this was statistically significant. And if you look at the patients that were under 18 millimeters of mercury, 100% of those patients were actually under 18 millimeters of mercury for their pressure at 6 months compared to only 86% of the iStent patients. So there was a significant difference there. Next slide. And this is really the most important part to really look at is the medication burden. I know we're looking at pressure, we always measure pressure, but I can't stress enough the importance of quality of life and improvement because patients are living longer and they will have glaucoma for the rest of their lives. And if we can reduce their medications, this is really an improvement in their quality of life, as I said. So if you look at these patients, at their medication burden, there's a huge reduction. iStent inject went from 2.3 medications preoperatively to postoperatively 0.4. This was an 80% or so reduction here in their medication burden. iStent itself went from 1.8 to 0.4, so about a 77% reduction in their medication burden. If you look at the patients that were medication-free, both iStent inject, 71.1%, and iStent itself, 74.3%, were about medication-free at 6 months. Again, stressing the importance of this. Next slide. So in conclusion, I just wanted to stress a couple points. I have seen a lot of these similar results in my own practice. I can attest to the difficulty of the procedure, actually teaching the new surgeons that are coming out into practice, the next generation of surgeons. And I just wanted to stress the importance of this procedure, really offering patients surgical advantages early in their disease process, as well as reducing their medication burden. It's really an important aspect that we can give them as care for care as patients. We agree with the coverage guidance section here that iStent inject is medically necessary per FDA labeled indication. The data from the randomized controlled trial, real world evidence, as well as ex vivo studies address the NGS's objection that a statistical benefit of multiple stenting has not been demonstrated. The more stents does lower intraocular pressure more, and that's really what we're stressing here. Work, effort, time, and intensity justifies the payment for the insertion of the additional stents as described by the CPT code 0376T, and we request that this code 0376T be moved from group 2 to group 1 and the related coding article A56588 billing and coding for microinvasive glaucoma surgery. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Tracu. Anyone else in the room or on the call have additional comments?
We have one person, Craig. So.
Right. They could identify themselves in any conflict of interest.
They're leaving the building.
It was not a question, Craig. We're done, I think, in the audience.
Okay. Operator, are there any questions on the line?
There are no questions via the phone.
Okay. So hearing no further questions, we'll consider this comments on this draft closed for the purpose of this meeting, as pointing out. Okay. The next slide. Water vapor, next draft under consideration for comment. Water vapor thermal therapy for lower urinary tract symptoms / BPH, DL37808. In this case, the change that was made was the policy criteria was liberalized in that the requirement that the patient have a significant obstructing median lobe component was removed. This restriction was put in there because the three-year data showed some worrisome trajectory in some of the data, and but yet. The device has particular benefit for patients with an obstructed median lobe over some of the alternatives. So we covered it, but required that it particularly have that component where this procedure seemed to potentially shine. And there were a dearth of alternatives. There, in the interim, there's four-year data that comes out that is reassuring in terms of those worrisome trajectories, and so we decided to liberalize the criteria and not require that the obstruction involve a median lobe requirement, but that it could just have general lateral or median or both type of obstructions. I don't think we received any requests to present, and this was, as I mentioned, as a result of new data, the four-year results that came out, which is listed there. Don't think we received any requests to present on this topic. Anyone in the room or on the call want to make a comment?
We have nobody in the room.
Operator, anybody online?
There are no questions via the phone.
Okay. In that case, we'll close comments on this draft as well, which is the final draft. Next slide. And as you mentioned, the comments extend beyond today to July 20th. And the next slide. This is the address to send in comments. I want to remind people that comments must be accompanied by a disclosure of any conflict of interest. So with that, Dr. Cunningham, I'll hand things back to you.
Thank you, Greg, very much. Oops. Got to turn the microphone back on. Thank you, Greg, very much. We might also want to turn the lights on. Anything we need to entertain as far as open discussion? Well, thank you all very much for those who are on the phone and also those who are here physically. We really appreciate your interest and your participation. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.
We're good at disconnecting.
That one, right?